Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast, where we're becoming experts at remote recordings. I won't share with you the extensive conversation we had about duvets and blankets before setting up. I'm instead going to launch into welcoming our very special guest for this podcast session, Paul Hood, Digital Marketing Director for The Sun. Welcome, Paul.
Good morning, Rachel. And I'm also intrigued by the duvet question about how do we improve the quality of audio. I've had some pretty horrendous hangouts over the past week or so, so I'm going to definitely be giving that a try.
Yeah, this is it. So, listeners, we had a brief conversation of top five tips from sound guy Rodney Lewis, who regular listeners are very familiar with, on how to improve your sound quality. And suffice to say that I have followed none of them, but I will make an effort to do better next week. And a big hello to Lindsay Rowntree, who actually probably has followed some of Rodney's top tips because you're in a different room today, Lindsay.
I could tell how annoyed sound guy was getting with me. So I thought I'll try out a different room that has a carpet in it. And I haven't got a duvet behind me yet, in front of me even, but I think this is, I've been told this is an improved sound. So
yeah,
if internet holds out, then we're good.
So really it's a case of incremental improvements. Let's see where we can get to next week. Cool. Okay. So let's move on to discussion of this week's news stories. First news story I wanted to chat with you guys about was an article that appeared in the FT late last week, focusing on how Chinese apps are actually doing quite well from a revenue perspective with some fairly significantly diversified revenue models, and that those have worked quite well during this time of global pandemic crisis. So the article is focusing, giving some specific examples, focusing on a podcasting app in China called Lizhi, at least that's how I pronounce it, L-I-Z-H-I, who knows whether that's right, and that they'd set up their revenue model actually about 3 or 4 years ago when they were struggling to work out how to turn huge traffic numbers into monetizable outputs without focusing solely on ad revenue and subscription services. What they did was took inspiration from a Japanese girl group who had apparently profited hugely from sales of their CDs via video and social media streaming platforms where they'd been streaming content to their fans in exchange for CD purchases and the opportunity to get involved in some of their online shows. And Lizhi used this as a bit of an inspiration to create a virtual gift platform. Now, the idea is that listeners purchase these virtual gifts with actual money and give them to their favourite podcast hosts, and then the platform takes commission from these sales. So quite impressively, this particular podcasting app has managed to build a business where 99% of their revenue is now accounted for from these virtual gift commission sales, which is relatively impressive. Anyway, the article goes into a little bit more detail about more probably well-known and understood Chinese streaming platforms such as Douyin, and how they've expanded that diversified revenue model into some form of kind of micropayments and virtual gifting, and then branched out into e-commerce and beyond. And the article draws a very stark comparison between those business models and the business models of other streaming platforms and perhaps social media platforms of Western economies, which are heavily ad revenue dependent. Now, of course, in this environment, being ad revenue dependent is a little bit turbulent, to say the least. So I thought this was a really interesting article. Very interested in the perspective of both of you guys on the point of view of diversified monetization strategies for publishers and content creators, and whether this is a particularly viable model. And I'm also interested to know your views on whether you think this is, particularly that example around virtual gifting, is that something that's got a bit of a sort of a cultural dimension to it? Is it something that's much more accepted and familiar, perhaps in Asian cultures where gaming is a really big part of interacting online? And or maybe there's a kind of generation response to this. Maybe this is something that's going to be, more easily taken up by younger people who are used to, again, that sort of gaming interactive environment. Paul, I'm going to go to you in the first instance for some perspective on this.
Sure. So I think it's a fascinating one to observe. I wonder whether I think your point about the cultural kind of dimension is actually quite plays quite a big part of this, because I'm not quite sure whether in Western economies and Western cultures, gifting, micro-gifting has really kind of gone beyond that, the kind of gaming sector, just yet. But what is interesting is that we certainly have seen a change in terms of content consumption for our title. So, you know, The Sun, The Times. And I wonder whether that increased engagement around potentially kind of what we would normally see as niche subject areas such as gardening, health and fitness, house and home, you know, being able to provide real-time response to people's questions about coronavirus. So, for example, we've got a daily live blog with Dr. Hillary, and we really have started to see really kind of deep engagement with topic areas that, you know, typically, you know, in normal times only really attract relatively kind of small audiences.
Yeah.
So I wonder whether there may be the opportunity for us to kind of think differently about the way that we monetize our audiences in light of that. And so perhaps not with gifting, although certainly be open to experimenting with it, but perhaps looking with more kind of focus and urgency around e-commerce opportunities, around that increased engagement levels that we're seeing there, and you know, this element of participation. So again, with Dr. Hillary answering questions live, you know, for the first time we've actually got people, you know, almost old school, kind of phoning in, if you like, or leaving their questions via email, and he's answering them and going through them live. And so you certainly could see that that could be potentially a show that attracts, you know, a particular type of brand, advertiser or sponsor that we wouldn't necessarily be able to influence to partner with us. So I think there's a lot of kind of new opportunities, but I think it's going to be about experimenting and trying new ideas.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, you know, the two things there. First, the fact that you've kind of got a sort of you've seen a real increase in demand and interest in that kind of live interactive environment. And like you said, particularly within perhaps niche categories. And then secondly, the idea that you could imagine how that could be expanded to offer advertisers opportunity perhaps around e-com. And I think the FT article went into some examples of that, some other Chinese streaming platforms using those sort of interactions as an opportunity where you've got somebody live streaming talking about particular, let's say, for example, if it was a gardening program, talking about solving particular gardening challenges, perfect opportunity for those gardening products to be popping up in a sort of an e-commerce environment and for purchases to be made then and there. It's kind of quite an interesting idea. I could see it working.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I say, it's certainly something that, you know, these past few weeks have really made us kind of reevaluate, you know, I guess the future shape of our business. You know, perhaps we have got this over-reliance on, you know, programmatic kind of display advertising. That's still clearly really important to us, but actually getting to understand what are the kind of topics that people really care about. So as opposed to kind of just sheer scale, you know, where there's that kind of direct correlation between revenue and page impressions, how do we think about monetizing engagement? So, you know, the loyal audiences who come back every day and who kind of choose, you know, our brand of news to keep them updated with what's going on, and who choose, you know, columnists within our portfolio to keep them updated. So yeah, I think it's going to be a kind of fascinating time, and it will certainly accelerate the way that we think about the value of our audiences.
Yeah, that's interesting, particularly the sort of community or consumer engagement angle as well. Lindsay, what's your point of view on this story?
I think I find it absolutely fascinating. And I think to, you know, Paul's point about the fact that this is probably much more of a cultural thing and you wouldn't necessarily see this in the West yet. I do agree with that. Like, I couldn't see myself being gifted a virtual lipstick, or the examples I gave were a virtual lipstick or a virtual bucket of chicken. And the whole thing I find strange, but I imagine in those kinds of cultures they find it very charming. However, the Doyen example, obviously to us in the West, Doyen is TikTok. And this is how TikTok makes a lot of its revenue, from influencers saying, well, that TikTok got in a lot of trouble in the West with young influencers doing this to people under the age of 18. And they were like 12-year-olds paying influencers 50 quid a pop. And they were promised things like their phone number if they sent them a virtual, what, there's things like drama queen and all these different kind of accolades that you can send your favorite influencer, and the influencer will get about 50% of that money and the rest will go to the platform, i.e. TikTok. So I think that not just is it cultural, I think it's also generational. Like, that obviously the young generation have no qualms in doing that. I think the older Western generation would find it, frankly, utterly bizarre. But then, as Paul said, now is the opportunity for us to be able to try out different things that we wouldn't normally think of doing. And the live example you gave, Paul, about Dr. Hillary, we talked about the live example, the liveness of the world last week in the podcast with the rise of a popularity of Facebook Live. And there's this need for people to be able to connect with people in a live environment where they can't go out and do it physically anymore. And I think that is something that I think would enhance this process. And I feel like if you were to... If, for example, a podcast app were to launch something similar in the West for, you know, for example, where we host our podcast, for example, Audiobeam, if they launched something similar, would there be the same kind of uptake? I don't think there would be. But if there was something that were catered more towards the Western environment and the way that we would feel comfortable doing things, I think it could be a good source of revenue where you can't rely on advertising. I think it's fascinating. And I think, you know, it's quite exciting to think about things like that. And it's these kind of crises force us into rejigging the way that we do things and not relying on things that have become like a crutch for us, basically. I think this could be something that's quite different. The one challenge, the example in the FT article I thought was interesting, talking about the world of gaming and where it's obviously very popular in gaming. You might buy like a chest of diamonds for the next task you have to do, or you might buy an outfit.
Weapons or whatever, yeah.
Exactly, like what made Fortnite very popular was kind of buying with outfits. They enhance your gaming experience in doing that. So you're paying money to actually enhance your gaming experience. What I don't understand, but then that's probably just me being older than the people that make the most of this, is how sending somebody a virtual bucket of chicken because you like their podcast is then enhancing your listening experience. And that, I think, is the trade-off. Kind of, where is the value? We talk a lot about value exchange, right? Where is the value exchange? If I send you, Rachel, or you, Paul, a bucket, or Rachel, I'll send you some chicken, Paul, I'll send you some lipstick. Where, what do I then get from that, apart from a really happy feeling that I've given you guys some lipstick?
Yeah, I totally get what you mean there, although I think you've just basically shot in the foot our chances of getting buckets of chicken there, Lindsay, which is very disappointing. But I totally know what you mean. I was thinking the same thing. I don't quite understand the principle behind this virtual gifting. I think the idea is, though, well, in the Lizzie podcast example anyway, is that these are such tiny micro purchases that you're talking about, you know, the equivalent of 10p here and 10p there. It's sort of more gimmicky than anything else. And then that is the thing that I think becomes a cultural thing, because that's not something that I think we're as culturally comfortable with as perhaps Asian cultures are, where, like you say, Lindsay, there's a whole set of sort of behaviours that are just considered sort of charming and polite and really pleasantly interactive, and they're things that they like to do. And, you know, even if I think, for example, of the time that I've spent in Asian countries, they take so much more care over the way that they package things and present things. You know, there's a real attention to detail around the interaction between you and consumer things. So perhaps it's tapping into that. I don't know. I'm really sort of making things up now and extrapolating. But I think the interesting thing that you've raised there is that we don't necessarily get that yet, but exactly what Paul said, and then you expanded on it, Lindsay, is these times are giving us an opportunity to experiment with everything, right? So why not think about how you might be able to morph that sort of model and apply it in a bit more of a culturally appropriate context here? And, yeah, I mean, I wonder, Paul, is that the sort of thing that you're finding yourself these are sorts of things that you're finding yourself discussing with some of your colleagues. Like you say, you know, programmatic advertising revenue is still really important to you, and it will continue to be so, not least of all because it's a very digitized channel, right? But you must all be putting your heads together trying to think about how you can do things a little more creatively at the moment.
Yes. And I think, you know, we're kind of playing it by ear in a sense, because we certainly don't want to, you know, exploit this current situation, if you like, negatively. We have to be kind of mindful that this is a, you know, a national emergency. And we're here really to kind of reflect the nation's kind of views and thoughts and concerns, and cover off the stories that are important to them. But I do think maybe when we look back, we'll say this was a moment that began to shift perhaps our kind of sense of identity, and perhaps you might, this might be too grand, but perhaps, you know, makes us a slightly more compassionate country, a nation. You know, we've seen the, you know, clapping our heroes every Thursday evening, how that's brought communities together. You know, and I can speak, you know, personally, because I generally work and stay in London during the week, but I live out in Suffolk. And so for me to be able to be at home on a Thursday evening, you know, I've met neighbours that I would never have met before. And I think what we're also seeing now is that, okay, that's an outpouring of gratitude for NHS and other key workers. And in The Sun this week, we launched an appeal to raise money, and we're asking Sun readers to donate what they can. And we set a really ambitious target of £1 million. We know that, you know, it's a really difficult time for a lot of our readers financially at the moment. But after just 3 days, we've reached £300,000 of donations from our readers. And I think what that shows is that people really do want to do something. And even if they're struggling themselves, they're quite keen to engage and participate and feel a sense of feel that they're able to contribute in some way. And I wonder whether, you know, after this has all passed, that will stick with us. And I wonder whether that will become a model where we look at audiences much more in terms of, you know, the things that they care about, the things that are important to them. And actually we're able to build, you know, business models off of the back of that rather than just relying on display advertising. So I think we're in for a kind of, you know, a fascinating time in the months ahead.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I completely agree. It would be, you know, it would be really nice to think that there is some of the, you know, some of the community spirit and some of the positive things that are coming out of this. It would be really nice to think that we can sustain those in some way. And it's also interesting to start thinking about sort of business sustainability connected to that, you know, this idea, because I think we touch on this quite a lot when we talk about, as we have done on this podcast as well, over the sort of 18 months that we've been running it, you know, digitally native brands, challenger brands, the DTC vertical, that a lot of those companies firstly are being founded and brought forward by young people, not in every case, but in many cases, and are reflective of the way that a lot of younger people want to consume things in their lives. So it's not just about convenience and very digitized, but it might also be about sort of, you know, a bit more of a sense of community, a bit more of a sort of, you know, something that feels morally aligned with their own personal individual morals. And this idea that businesses could tap into that, and not in a you know, purely sort of, not from a purely self-serving point of view, but rather from a sustainable point of view, you know, how actually can we build these business models such that we're not relying on sort of potentially the easy solution, but we're doing something that's a bit more holistic, and therefore we're engaging with our customers and our consumers and our audiences in different ways. I'd imagine that this is potentially an opportunity for those marketers that have always been talking about how businesses need to be built from the point of view of customer engagement up. It's a real opportunity for them to start kind of shining.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the areas we've seen has been the absence of live sport. So as you'd imagine, we get huge levels of engagement and huge audiences congregating around the sport content that we produce every day. And, you know, we've now been through a sustained period with no live sport. But actually, you know, incredibly, we've seen, you know, higher levels of engagement with the content that we've put out. So whether that's looking back and archive content, or whether it's creating quizzes and games around sports, and in particular, again, niche sports as well as you know, the popular sports that you'd expect, like football and so forth. You know, the horse racing community, for example, has kind of really come together because, you know, the welfare of animals and the welfare of, you know, all of the jockeys and all of the stable hands and, you know, that whole economy around horses, you know, that affects people's lives in a way that, of course, perhaps Premiership footballers, you know, aren't going to be massively financially impacted by this. But some sporting communities really do care. And that's been quite apparent actually to us. And so I think we will, you know, so for example, with Sun Racing, which is our horse racing channel, we've given people the opportunity to kind of sign up to bulletins, you know, so that they can keep abreast of issues that are really kind of close to their hearts, whether that's animal welfare, whether it's the, you know, updates from a jockey club, whatever it might be. And actually we've seen, you know, a faster rate of sign up to our Sun Racing newsletter in this time where we haven't got much horse racing content to offer. So I think, yeah, we've actually found probably, you know, the really kind of passionate core of horse racing fans in this time, ironically, when there's no horse racing on. So, and the same with football. You know, our dream team, which is our fantasy football game. You know, although people can't, you know, really engage with the game, they can't make their transfers, there's no points to be scored. So what they are doing is they're following, you know, the Dream Team social media channels even more avidly. And we're expanding, you know, our content output into channels like TikTok. And we're actually managing to keep those audiences engaged. And I think the next step for us is to really make as many of our customer base kind of become known to us. So rather than just having this large kind of anonymous audience at times, if we can drill down and offer propositions that are sufficiently compelling for people to register for them, as with Sun Racing, even at times when there's no horse racing on, then when it comes back, we've got a really kind of warm prospect pool of super fans. And I think on our side, we will respond by be much more circumspect and kind of respecting, you know, the fact that these people have kind of stuck with us through this difficult time. And we will, you know, we will put a lot of effort into making sure that we super serve those audience segments that have demonstrated that they really appreciate the content that comes from our brand.
Every publisher needs to listen to that, because this is what we've been moaning about for weeks and weeks. Obviously, the plight of the publisher is a massive problem at the moment, and it's one that we sympathise with hugely. But one thing that we've talked about, and Kieran wrote an article a couple of weeks ago talking about the opportunities out there, that with things like engaging with your audience in a different way, and the examples of trying to embrace doing things like games and quizzes online with them, that you can engage with them, you can monetize them, you can understand your audience, grow your audience. You've just given some amazing examples, and the sporting thing is fascinating about the fact that your audience is almost more engaged now than they were when there was actual live sport playing. These are some great opportunities that you guys are taking here.
And I mean, also, you wouldn't necessarily have had the opportunity to gather that insight if it wasn't for this sort of strange kind of pause in business as usual that we're all experiencing, right? So it's just fantastic to hear that you're using that time wisely to not just be offering up, you know, doubling down on content and looking for content opportunities and offering that up to your readers and to your audience, but also you're interrogating that a little bit more and working out who that audience actually is, and thinking about how you can best serve them when things sort of ping back and return to normal. I must I must admit, I was highly amused by my sister-in-law WhatsApping me in the week to say my brother was re-watching or was watching reruns of World Darts Championship. Okay, things are content consumption opportunities are getting hit on the ground. To which, of course, she said, no, you know how much he loves World Darts Championship, which is quite true. So, yeah, and I mean, it's interesting that you say it because I had thought in the week, surely reruns of great sporting moments and, you know, rerunning content or delving back into historical sporting content, that's got to be hugely popular. People love that stuff at the best of times.
Yeah, they do. And I guess the other thing that I've really seen, which has been, you know, I guess quite humbling in a way, which is, you know, and I guess, you know, I'd like to pay, you know, huge kind of credit and appreciation to the journalists who kind of carry on through this time, you know, very self-sufficient. So instead of kind of sitting back and thinking, okay, there's no sport, there's nothing for me to do, you know, they're creating for their audiences, you know, this really kind of engaging content. And then, of course, you've got the journalists who are still going to work, you know, almost seen as key workers to cover, you know, stories, putting themselves in kind of dangerous positions. And I think that audiences will remember that. And I think they will respect those kind of brands who have been with them through this crisis. And so I think, yeah, perhaps, you know, when we emerge from all of this, we may be more focused on less of the kind of flighty kind of traffic and content and much more focused on, you know, the content verticals and the topics that, you know, people have shown that they really care about. So I think that, you know, that's definitely, you know, a silver lining for us as well.
Fascinating stuff, Paul. And we're only one story into the podcast, so I'm going to move us on because we can come back to talking about some more of that towards the latter half of the podcast. Okay, so next news story I wanted to talk about was the WSJ reporting on a merger between Foursquare and Factual earlier on in the week. No disclosure of the financial terms of the deal, very much emphasising that it's a merger rather than an acquisition. Actually, I think it was Foursquare acquired another location software tool earlier on, earlier on last year, called Placed. But I thought this was interesting because it just made me reflect for a moment on the sort of, you know, world of location data and location data sciences and tools. Obviously, we're not moving around quite the way that we have been, in ordinary day-to-day life. So you can imagine that they will inevitably be experiencing difficulties during this time, like so many other people within the advertising supply chain are. But what was interesting about this is that the two have come together to sort of, make more significant their location data and services offering. So covering everything from location data to volume of footfall, to audience, more sophisticated audience segmentation, attribution, and measuring the effectiveness of advertising placements. Now, what was interesting as well about this article is they touched upon the fact that apparently in the US, they are actually, as part of this merger, the sort of newly merged company, are sharing anonymous data with government response teams and public health agencies to help them focus in on population movement and behaviour during the pandemic lockdown, which I thought was really interesting. So it made me think a little bit about location data and tools, made me wonder whether actually is this one particular area of advertising technology that might sort of spring back to life quite quickly once the crisis is over, because it is still, you know, it's extremely, you know, targeted towards a mobile environment, and it's something that it, as it becomes more and more sophisticated, you can imagine advertisers really needing to, you know, take more and more advantage of it. Is it something that could also be rolled out for use across a sort of public health and a sort of social infrastructure point of view? And is there an opportunity for companies like this to get involved in that going forward? And then Is it also the sort of technology that could still be used by advertisers at the moment? I appreciate we're not necessarily going far, but we are, if we're well and we're not vulnerable, still able to leave our homes, at least to go to supermarkets or the pharmacy or whatever. Again, I can imagine that therefore the advertising opportunities might be a bit limited, but there are still advertising opportunities. And I'm also just wondering, I guess this will come down to how sophisticated some of the tools are. Just wondering if there is a possibility to use these location tools to be advertising specific things to people during times of lockdown. And I want to know what you guys think about that. Lindsay, let's mix it up. Start with you. Get your opinion on that first.
I mean, I find it is an interesting time for a merger like that to happen, but I guess it makes sense. There's a lot of stuff they can do together that's not necessarily ad-related at the moment. And I think the fact that they are using their data for good, if you like, by trying to help the authorities and help the health officials be able to understand more about the movement of people, obviously anonymously, I think is very interesting. And I think that actually there are probably other companies like that out there that have similar access to similar types of data that could also do similar things where they are maybe losing out at the moment. And, you know, how can we repurpose ourselves to actually be doing something useful during this time? If we can't be doing, if we've had a cut in ad revenue, how do we kind of continue doing something that's helpful? So I think that's an interesting point there. I think the interesting thing here is the fact that obviously there's this big stress on the fact the data will be anonymous, and they can't or won't use it for the likes of contact tracing, which obviously they're doing heavily in Asia. I think that's an interesting thing because we don't want to do that from a data privacy perspective, but at the same time, is there a call to do that from the continued safety of nations? And it's this whole kind of, you know, when does AI work for good or evil? Like, actually, if this data could be used for something useful, use something good that could actually potentially help save lives, how does that affect your data privacy, and how does that affect how people regard data privacy? So I think there's an interesting conversation around that as well. To be honest, which I think is something that will probably get explored as it continues, because it isn't going anywhere.
Mm.
So the Foursquare thing, I didn't really like Foursquare. To me, is a bit of a joke of a social media platform that people used to use all the time to kind of work out where to go. I didn't know it was really still a thing. I had no idea that in the back end, it's powering the likes of Snap location data, Twitter, and Uber as well. Completely news to me. So I think that it's an interesting, and that them coming together will be very, very interesting, because there's actually, even in lockdown, as you say, Rachel, there's still a hell of a lot that can be done with location data. And I often get location served ads to my mobile that are relevant, would be relevant if I lived where I worked. So obviously with London, we have zones. So they are tools, for example, like local supermarkets available to me if I lived in zone one, but they're no use to me living in zone three. So that always frustrates me that I can't actually make use of this tool that you keep serving me. You must be able to have an idea of where I am most if I'm working, where I work versus where I live, because that data is available. But now that we're at home all the time, actually, even not even geolocation data from the sense of pings, it's actually more even postcode level data is really useful during this time. There's a lot that advertisers could be doing to be targeting people using more basic location data that we've always had access to. I think there's got massive opportunity there. It's not just about the fact that there's less motility, so people, you know, that data is now defunct. Actually, it could even be more useful and could actually give advertisers a chance to understand their audiences even better than they could when they were just going work home the whole time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder if this will make some of the location data tools and software become even more sophisticated. I mean, no doubt, you know, those vendors will be working on the sophistication of their tools ordinarily as business as usual anyway. But this is a real opportunity, if they've got higher levels of sophistication, for them to be speaking to some of their clients, their agency clients and advertiser clients, to say, these are the things we can offer you. Seems like a potential opportunity. Mm. What's your view, Paul?
I think what Lindsay said is really accurate. And I think that point in particular about using the technology for good is something that advertisers will need to be really thoughtful about, because it can seem really, really creepy when you get notifications or ads displayed to you, which, you know, you're just not clear how an advertiser got that data to know that you would be responsive to that offer or be in this particular location. So I think if they're using location data to understand their audiences to kind of better target and provide more relevant advertising. I think that's great. But yeah, just that, I suppose that's the note of caution, is that customers can get kind of freaked out quite easily by, and then actually can be really put off brands because they feel that somehow, you know, these brands must have engaged in some kind of, you know, surveillance.
Various activity.
But look, undoubtedly location data, you know, provides really powerful context and kind of, you know, intent information that that other data doesn't provide. And I think, you know, there are all sorts of examples of, you know, where it can be used, you know, on a fairly simple, in fairly simple ways. So, for example, with us, you know, one of our long-standing partners is Merlin Entertainment, and they launched a new Bear Grylls adventure park up near Birmingham last year. And their research kind of really showed that, you know, the audience type was, you know, males kind of 30 to 45. But what was really interesting was that they did some research around the amount of effort and money that these that their target audience are prepared to kind of spend. And one of the big things around the effort was how far they're prepared to travel. And so, you know, again, not particularly sophisticated, but targeting people within an hour's distance. And so that hour could be an hour away on the train, which is very different from an hour away's drive. And so actually being able to target those people. So they're actually able to target, you know, a good cohort of people in North London, actually, because you can get, you know, from King's Cross to, you know, close to Birmingham in just over an hour. And so that was a big part of their messaging. So I think location data definitely is going to become more and more powerful and relevant. I guess it's, you know, the point around privacy that Lindsay's made is a really important one. And I think, you know, maybe instead of just thinking about commercial operations or businesses with the profit motive, I think, and especially coming out of the situation that we're in, it may well be that charities are able to exploit, you know, these new technologies, because we've all been stuck indoors for a long time. You know, we will all be much more predisposed to be generous, you know, instead of chucking stuff out, perhaps take it to charity shops, support local community causes and so forth. And actually, if, you know, I've got no idea where the local charity shops are in, you know, in the village I live in Suffolk, because I don't spend lots of time here, or the nearest town. And I would definitely not be put off if it was the NHS or charitable organisations who were using that data to suggest to me that, you know, I could do something good for my community. So I think ultimately location data has to be used with care, but certainly I think we'll see more and more use of it in ad targeting as well.
Yeah, and I think the key thing there, Paul, picking up on what you've just said, is sophistication rather than kind of creepiness, right? That's what everybody wants, is some level of sophistication that gives them confidence that this data is being used for the right purposes or appropriate purposes. It's interesting, the charity sector example that you give, I think that is 100% a real opportunity for charitable organisations. It won't go, unnoticed by anyone that's listening to this in the UK, that in the daily coronavirus briefing from Number 10 yesterday, the Chancellor, was it yesterday? Might have even been the day before. No, I think it was yesterday, the Chancellor announced a package of financial support for charitable organisations, which is, you know, a way of signifying that they understand that charities are being just as hard hit by this complete pause in our lives as everybody else is. Their funding sources have dried up. They're not able to run any of their funding and live event fundraising campaigns, and this is having an enormous impact on a lot of organisations who support a whole lot of vulnerable people. So, yeah, the being able to use location data and location software to try to work out, you know, where potential people that they can interact with and people that might want to donate to them would be hugely powerful. And on that note, you know, the first time that I got to understand anything about, you know, we can call it customer segmentation or audience segmentation, was actually many, many moons ago when I worked in the public sector, and we used at the time Experian data to do population profiling so that we could work out how to target our services to the people that most needed them. So, you know, that kind of information and data is absolutely just as valuable on a public sector, you know, sort of social infrastructure and public healthcare basis as it is on a kind of commercial basis. And on that note, just one other thing, and I'd be interested in your points of view on this, because Lindsay, you touched on it. It is interesting to wonder for a moment what that sort of location data can do from a public health point of view that could be used in times of crisis like this, because we know of examples in Asian countries where they've done just that. So in Singapore, there is an app that they will download. So their contact tracing is very sophisticated, and obviously they use location data for that amongst many other things. But if you have been tested and you are positive and have the coronavirus, they download an app on your phone, which you cannot delete, that shows the public health officials where you are, because the idea is you have to stay isolated within your house. And if you roam outside of that zone, the app pings and someone turns up and wraps you over the knuckles and potentially gives you a fine. Now, I know that's something that people would be very resistant to in most European countries and Western societies, but it is interesting to think about that for a while, because there is also, which I bet many listeners and certainly Lindsay, and I wonder if you're familiar with it too, Paul, there's the COVID-19 tracker app that we're all encouraged to complete, which is about reporting whether we feel well or unwell, and if we feel unwell, what our symptoms are. That information is going to King's College Hospital and University Trust to compile a whole load of data and information for research purposes. Well, and that's got location tracking on it too, and it pings your, I mean, they're not necessarily doing anything with it, but it's not very sophisticated at the moment, the location tracking, but it's enough to sort of ping you and remind you whether you've actually filled out the app on a daily basis. And you can imagine that those sorts of things might become a bit more accepted in our societies after this. That's my opinion anyway. I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, I think they might have to. I think that we've been able to go a long time without having to kind of get drawn into those kinds of things. And we've always looked at examples in the East and gone, oh God, they're like, there's, it's so creepy. They're just following their citizens around, and they know exactly what they're doing the whole time. But it's potentially worked in their favour in during this crisis, because in Wuhan, the contact tracing element has enabled them to be able to gradually get back into some like semblance of normality in society again. We won't have the same ability to be able to do that, because we're going to worry about opening the floodgates and not being able to have a clue about what anyone's doing or where they're doing it. And I think that highlights that we need to have some kind of, maybe not as extreme as China, but some kind of middle ground, surely, that doesn't make us feel like we're being watched by the overlords, but that will make us feel a bit safer in what we're doing.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's the key point, that, you know, it can't feel like imposed surveillance. People will react really badly to that. So I think it's about that sense of control that you give ultimately your customers. So whether your customer is a, you know, COVID-19 app tracker user, you know, they're willingly downloading that app, allowing kind of location data to be sent to all of the places that are going to use it to ultimately help stamp out this disease more quickly. And so I think consent is the key word, really. And that applies to commercial uses as well. So I don't actually mind if you know, sometimes I commute to London on a motorbike, sometimes I commute on a train. And actually, I can tell that Google knows which mode of transport I'm using, just because of the time it takes, even though the routes are very similar. And so if it kind of lets me know that, it's going to be raining on the way home, so, I should get my wet weather gear out or whatever, that's helpful. I would still want to have explicitly given consent for, any advertisers who are going to potentially use that data to target me. Sometimes that's really helpful. Sometimes, it's not. And I think it's just about that tricky balance of making sure that the customer does have the control. In ways that, hitherto, especially with programmatic advertising, people have kind of lost trust. A lot of customers have kind of lost trust that, there's a whole load of technology working in the background for the advertiser's benefit. But there hasn't been that many clear examples that these advertisers are kind of taking their customers' kind of priorities seriously. They're just thinking about the, the commercial kind of profit motive and commercial imperative. So I think going forward, that's going to be the tricky bit. But for brands that get it right, I think they will certainly have a competitive advantage, and ultimately, use that information to get closer to their customers and to provide, better services and to sell, more goods and services to them.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, that was, in theory anyway, supposed to be the point of legislative, sort of movements like GDPR, never mind whether it's actually got us there yet or not. That's another matter. But the idea has got to be, explicit consent, explicit opt-in, and the understanding of explicit, surveillance, if we want to call it that, since there's no other sort of more positive term to refer to it at the moment. Because let's not forget that there's a lot of covert surveillance that goes on out there, legitimately or otherwise, and we just, it's just that it's covert, so we either don't know about it or we kind of convince ourselves it doesn't happen. The point is there's got to be a sort of a marrying between our expectations as consumers and then our business practices as businesses, whether we're advertisers or whether we're advertising technology vendors. That all needs to be flushed out a little more sort of obviously. Anyway, I'm going to move us on to – oh, sorry, Lindsay, go on.
I was going to say Google has all this data. Like, you can download the data of every single place you visited at the exact time you visited and the exact house number you were at. If Google wanted to, it could bring down society with telling everybody where they were. Like, there'd be so many marriage failures because of people having affairs and saying they were at work when they weren't. Like, Google could do, if Google were able to release this data, there could be so many crimes that were solved as well by people claiming they had alibis and they were actually somewhere completely different. And I think that is the thing. We know this data exists, and Google is the one company that has access to all of it because it's tracking everywhere we go all the time and exactly what we're doing and how we're getting there. And that if it were able to, it could be put to very good use, but also very, very terrifying use. I think that is the big concern. Like, what step is a step too far?
God, yeah, that's a quite a terrifying sort of new world that you've just scoped out for us there, Lindsay. great. Well, I'm going to move us on to the third story, and I'm going to actually use this story as a segue to launch into the second part of the podcast because we're starting to run tight on time. This has just been such a great conversation. I'm going to introduce this story, get your views on it, and Paul, invite you to talk a little bit about how you're approaching things at the Sun at the moment. So this story was reported by Digi Day earlier on in the week. It's actually an interview with the CEO of BBC Global News talking about media businesses during a time of crisis and how they're handling things over at BBC Global News and how they're handling some of the challenges that we've been discussing. We've been discussing with it last week when we had Lara O'Reilly from DigiDay on the podcast, and we've been discussing it over the last couple of weeks. How publishers are coping with, huge increase in volumes of traffic, but challenges to their revenue models. So some highlights from this particular interview that I wanted to note was that BBC, like many other, or Global News section of BBC anyway, like many other news media outlets, is just experiencing a massive increase in traffic up nearly 100% from the same time previous year. So they've got an enormous increase in traffic to their new site properties. But they talked also about how incredibly sudden and pronounced their advertising revenue downturn was. So dealing with those challenges pretty much at equal ends of the extreme of the spectrum at the same time can't be underestimated in terms of how difficult it must be to navigate a business through that. They talked about how turbulent it was, but that also they're starting to see some advertising spend come back from Asia, because obviously, you know, their global news brand is international. So they were saying that already they're starting to see some tourism spending coming back from China, which is interesting and hopeful for anyone in the travel industry and travel vertical, that maybe that has an opportunity to bounce back, with some swiftness once things start to loosen up a little bit more, once life starts to loosen up a little bit more. But there was a couple of principles that they talked about in the article that I thought were really interesting, particularly interested in your views on these, Paul, and how you're approaching the Sun, which is the need to be flexible, to be responsive to your readership and your audience, to kind of know and understand what it is that readership and audience is looking for. And I mentioned this specifically because Lara last week talked about how she viewed, as a journalist who writes for a trade publication but has got a very vast range of experience in her journalism career, talks about how her opinion is that as a journalist, her job is to be helpful, right? And during a time when, you know, there's really only one main story and everything else is the subset of that story, then the point of news media is to be helpful, is to provide the right information for their audiences. So that's certainly what the BBC were talking about. And then they also obviously touched upon how challenging it is to get marketers' attention and advertisers' attention in a positive way in this landscape, that arbitrary rules and measures are not really working, to everyone's benefit at the moment. And the example they gave is keyword block lists are just creating havoc. You can imagine why. We also mentioned that last week in our podcast as well. But the way really to navigate, or the way that they're choosing to try to navigate around that, is to try to just work much more closely and directly with the advertising clients to understand what it is they're looking to achieve, because it's really about striking that sort of balance between, what messages are useful during times of crisis and trying to identify where the opportunities are. So I found that all really interesting. And then they sort of underpinned it by saying, well, the traditional rules in terms of your advertising model are just thrown out of the window at the moment. So you can't just sort of adopt a, different approach every day attitude. You've got to come up with a plan, but you've got to be willing to just disperse with all of your traditional tools and methods and start thinking a bit more creatively. So really interested to hear your point of view on that, Paul, and maybe talk a bit about what's happening over at the Sun.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's been fascinating actually to see how this coronavirus has changed the way that we kind of approach business. And I think your point, Rachel, there about being more collaborative, that is definitely a theme that we've seen. And so not just, internally, but for example, at The Sun and The Times, we are working much more collaboratively with other news media publishers. So for example, in order to make sure that everybody can get their copy to, the reduced outlets in time, publishers have agreed kind of earlier off-stone times, for example, so that if they're printed, in our case by newsprinters, and we also print a lot of other newspapers from competitors, it's really kind of been interesting to see that response, because you just cannot imagine in our world changing off-stone times, for example. They've been the same.
It's a difficult nightmare, I imagine.
Yeah, and it's that kind of collaboration, I think, that is making businesses think differently. So where that has been a tradition, and it's almost always seen as a kind of a can't move element of the publishing model, actually we've seen that we can move it. And actually, not only can we move it, but we've been able to get other publishers to move it as well. I mean, that's a really small example, but what resonated mostly most with what you just said earlier is, you know, I do think our job is to be helpful through this period. One of the things that we're thinking about already is we know that small businesses, and in particular kind of the restaurant trade, gyms and so forth, will have been really negatively kind of impacted through this period. So we're already thinking about, you know, a campaign to help get Britain back on its feet, you know. And so as, you know, the Sun is, you know, the UK's kind of number one news media brand, we almost think that we have a responsibility to help our readers and to help the businesses that they work in, or whether they're sole traders, to get back on their feet after that. And so, you know, we haven't scoped out exactly what that campaign is going to consist of, but we will definitely be putting a lot of resource and effort into helping people, you know, so our readers and our advertisers get back to kind of business and try and make up for some of the damage that this virus has caused, you know, their businesses, their families, the economy and so forth. And so I think we do feel that sense of responsibility, and it's a time for us to give back. And I'm really proud that the Sun is doing that. As I mentioned earlier, we've launched this campaign to allow our readers to support, you know, their NHS heroes. We've got awards coming up in May, the Who Cares Wins Awards, which is all about recognising and celebrating some of our great emergency service workers. And this year in particular, we'll be really focused on celebrating, you know, those people who've put themselves in harm's way to keep us safe and to try and get us through this crisis as quickly as possible. So we've seen lots of examples of how, you know, this crisis has changed the way we think about our business. And I think the final point is, you mentioned the opportunity for brands to kind of work with publishers direct. I think that will probably become a theme as we come out of the back of this crisis as well, because I wonder whether, you know, we've kind of gone too far down the programmatic route and just allowed, you know, audiences to be audiences rather than, you know, of similar value, rather than kind of diving into saying, okay, is this a trusted kind of brand environment? Is this, you know, how did this brand act during these difficult times? How did it support its customer base? What did it do for kind of the public good? I'm really proud that the Sun in particular, and the Times, of course, have acted really responsibly through this time period. And I think that will bode well for us commercially in the future, because I think brands, advertisers will want to be associated with us. So I think we've done the right thing, and many others have as well. Yeah, I think it will be interesting, but I do think that might be one of the themes, more direct conversations with publishers rather than just using programmatic as a channel.
And are you noticing, Paul, I mean, maybe it's just too early to tell, but are you sort of noticing the start of that process? Have you been having conversations with any of your sort of advertising clients, any of your marketing clients that are a bit more, I mean, has that direct conversation started anywhere yet?
It has actually. So even in today's paper, I was just looking, you know, so when I mentioned the Who Cares Wins and our aim to raise £1 million for good causes, we've started to see brands engaging with that, which wasn't necessarily actually the point of it. So we, the Sun, put in £50,000 donation to get the fund started. And today, H. Samuel have matched that and given £50,000 as well, which is quite phenomenal. And I think, you know, they're seeing that this is an opportunity for their brand to do some good and to be seen to be doing some good. And certainly with the supermarkets and the grocers, who are, you know, great partners of ours, we are having detailed conversations with them week to week to see how we can help get their messages out editorially. And of course, they've continued to support us from an advertising point of view through this crisis. So I think the relationships that we have with some of our existing customer base have certainly been strengthened through this. So they're definitely the positives.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Lindsay, what's your point of view on sort of, you know, the world of media businesses during time like this?
I think Paul's point about kind of how brands are staying visible during all this, we talked about this last week as well, we looked at the global financial crisis in 2008, and it was the brands that remained visible during that time that were the ones that were that kind of got through it and were able to kind of do well the other side of it. Because we had to remember, Rachel, you referred to it yesterday as the new abnormal, which I'm now calling it, because I've been calling it the new normal, but it's not, it's abnormal. In this new abnormal that we live in, there will be another side to it, and that other side will look very different from where it was before we started. Things, you know, will be very, very different in from a number of different ways. But it's brands that want to be able to be seen to be doing something. If they want to be visible, they need to be visible in the right way. You need to make sure that their messaging is correct, their strategy around this is correct. They shouldn't be doing the same strategy they had before, but they need to not be going through a quiet period and hunkering down if they're not able to. If they've got money to put out there, put that money out towards something valuable and a good cause and do something right. It doesn't mean you can't still advertise, you still need to acquire business. But as long as that becomes part of your strategy too, there's a lot to be said for that. You know, we talked as well, you know, King, for example, across all of their game sets, they're giving users free lives to give them to, so they haven't got to pay money. That will give it be a drop in revenue for them, but they won't, but that will be noticed on the other side of this. And they've also partnered with WHO to ensure that there's unity in gaming, and there's always different kind of initiatives out there. And I think H. Samuel, the example of that with the Who Cares Wins Awards, putting something towards it, that's money that they, you know, could be putting back in their business to actually be helping their business come through this, but actually putting that 50 grand towards like matching for NHS Heroes or whatever, it makes a lot of sense. And that's what I think brand, like media businesses need to be thinking about, is being, like, not throwing money at things necessarily, but being visible in the right way, I think is the most important thing. And not being concerned about, there's too much worry about the word coronavirus in all of this and the word COVID-19, and that needs to be stopped, because that is just part of this new world we live in, that will be everywhere. So they need to pull away from that being the fearful term. Like, that there's not much concern around that now, because everyone's living it and you can't avoid it, and you won't be chastised or judged for being around or associated with that word, as long as you can make sure you're doing so in a positive way.
Absolutely. I mean, Lara mentioned it last week, didn't she, that, you know, and I think I said it earlier, you know, coronavirus is the only story or the story at the moment, but it doesn't mean that there aren't subset stories underneath that. You just need to accept that the entire backdrop is coronavirus, because it is the biggest thing that has happened in most of our lifetimes, quite possibly, from a sort of, you know, global crisis point of view. So Paul, are you noticing that, you know, from your point of view, do you think some brands are getting a bit more brave about the notion of appearing against particular content? Are they still just as worried today as they were, say, 4 weeks ago, or are they on a journey like the rest of us?
Yeah, it's a good question, and we're definitely seeing a shift. I mean, yes, there was the issue that advertisers were kind of having a blanket block list against coronavirus content, for example. And I think, we've seen that, well, that is the content that people care most about, and they're really interested and engaged with it. So it probably doesn't make sense to not be able to reach those people at a time when they're leaning in to that content. And in particular, if media brands are doing a good job of helping people get through this period with information, advice, tips, and they're getting a closer connection to those audiences, then it's almost counterproductive for advertisers to kind of stay away from them. So yes, we are definitely seeing that. And I think the other thing that I'd say is, there's been an awful lot of fake news spread around coronavirus on platforms like Facebook, and that leaches into WhatsApp and so forth. And I'm sure you've both seen, some pretty horrendous kind of fake news stories. You know, I think the established news media brands, you know, we have a code of conduct that we have to abide by. You know, we are liable for the content that we put out in a way that, you know, Facebook and others, other digital platforms aren't. And I think there is this question about quality and provenance. And perhaps, you know, I can see a, you know, a flight back to more direct engagements with news media brands. And so perhaps, you know, an Ozone is a really good example of, you know, a publisher alliance where you, advertisers don't have to necessarily pick a brand. By picking Ozone, they can be assured that, you know, their adverts are reaching, you know, an audience of scale, but quality, trusted content, you know, in a transparent environment. And so I can see that projects, initiatives like Ozone could do well out of the back of this. And perhaps it's just an opportunity for advertisers to kind of rethink their strategy and rethink the media brands, that the premium media brands that they should be kind of aligning their spend towards, and not just necessarily going for the kind of cheapest page views they can get via Facebook or Google. So I think that is well, hopefully that's an outcome that will be positive for publishers.
Yeah, because I was just about to ask you, actually, if you feel that perhaps this is setting up a scenario where, you know, your potentially your interaction with partners, advertisers and brands might become somewhat more consultative. You know, it's the idea that you want to find a solution that best fits them, that also best suits your audience. So I'm pulling together a few things here. It's the notion that you're getting to know your audience a little bit better. I mean, you no doubt already had a bit of insight, but these unprecedented times are giving you more. You then therefore have an opportunity to maybe have more of a detailed conversation with your advertiser partners about what might suit them. And then that's naturally lending itself perhaps to, you know, the sophistication of some of the collaboration tools or the collaboration setups that you mentioned, like Ozone, adding sophistication to what they can offer to advertisers. So, like you say, it's creating an environment where brands are feeling a bit more compelled to advertise with traditional news media platforms because they know what they're getting, and also they're having perhaps more of a direct engagement with them. Do you think that's possible?
Yeah, I definitely do. You know, what we've seen, as I've mentioned, is that we've got customers explicitly signing up to particular content areas that they're really interested in, whether that's horse racing, gardening, you know, Dr. Hillary, whether it's employment. So again, you know, with The Sun, you know, we have a big job section, and there's been a huge focus on us making sure that people who are out of work, we're guiding them to new job opportunities that they wouldn't necessarily be aware of. And we're building these kind of databases and helping these people, you know, our customers at a time of need. And I guess it's what happens next. So, you know, we've got, you know, our fastest ever growing newsletter has been as you'd imagine, the COVID-19 newsletter on The Sun. For us, the challenge is going to be, you know, what do we do with that newsletter database after all of this? And so we're working really hard kind of behind the scenes to stitch those identities together so that we can start to understand, you know, to profile those people so that rather than just stopping the bulletins, we can pass them over into content areas that we know they'll be interested in or will likely be interested in. And I think, you know, as I've said, because we now have a much deeper understanding of the really passionate audience segments that we have in each of the areas across the broad church of content that is The Sun, we'll be able to offer advertisers a much more kind of personalized advertising proposition, and potentially that will extend to, you know, being able to communicate directly, you know, whether it's through sponsorship of email newsletters or whatever, with these groups of people, rather than relying on, as I say, kind of programmatic targeting to kind of hope that that they reach them at a time where they're interested in their brand. So I think direct relationships will definitely strengthen. And yeah, really interesting. We're a scaled business. So, you know, we reach 37 million people a month on The Sun. But actually within that, you know, we're using this time to kind of profile our audience and figure out who are the really strong brand advocates and how do we make sure we kind of super serve them in terms of content. But if we can do that, then I guess it also means on the flip side that we're able to offer, you know, a much more engaged audiences to advertisers.
Yeah, well, exactly like Lindsay said earlier on, every publisher needs to hear that. This is the time to be doing that, to be doing those, to be undertaking those tasks and focusing on that work. Okay, thanks, guys. We're going to have to wrap up there because we're well and truly over time. Thanks so much for joining us, Paul.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. Really enjoyed the talk.
Not at all. And I'm very glad we didn't have to be all under duvets with our heads on the duvets. And I just love the fact that that's what we thought Rodney meant, when he said, anyway, never mind, we can get into that next week. Thank you, Lindsay, over there from the Walthamstow studio.
Thank you.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.